Hey everybody, this is Andy, aka Love Retro BTW, across Twitter, Instagram, and Twitch. I do a podcast every Saturday called Cafe BTW, a morning gaming podcast, a retrospective look at the wonderful world of retro gaming, from interviews to guests. Join us every Saturday, like a Saturday morning cartoon, starting at 8 a.m., 11 a.m. Eastern. Also, if you're on Twitter, please join the brand new retro gaming community, a place to share, connect, and show your love for the retro gaming community. All the links are down below. And remember, enjoy the Gamers Week podcast.
This time on Gamers Week podcast.
There are going to be so many people out there that go, huh?
Right, I've never even heard of a CDI.
Right. Like, we know it because we're nerds, but we're not your average person.
Right.
It's like, man, I really love the voice acting on that one game on the Apple Pippin. You know?
It's like, oh, the dude that played the Scat Commander in Night Trap, he should have gotten a freaking Emmy, man.
Yes, yes.
That stash was legendary.
All the relationships in this life, only one or two.
But why? Why?
Because it's in the reviews, reactions, and requests.
That doesn't mean you have to sing it.
Going so fast.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I hate you both.
Yeah, yeah.
I just want you to know the listeners hate you too.
What's it going in there, or is it DMCA?
Somehow I've been thinking they'll be like, yeah, we'll let them have that one.
All right, you guys ready?
I'm ready.
Welcome to Gamers Week Podcast. Like the name says, we analyze the best, worst, and weirdest headlines of the past week in the video game industry. This is episode 30. We're gonna have some dirty 30 action today.
You know it.
And today is Wednesday, July 13, 2022. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. My name is Blue Williams, and I'll be your host for this evening. But I have with me my two co-hosts. My first co-host will talk Southern to you all day long for the right price.
I got three fitty.
My second co-host wants to be referred to from now on as the Pringles Daddy. Please say hello to Ryan Payne, aka Retro Game Brews, and the one and only Donnie G.
Hey, everybody.
Hello, hello.
I got the Pringles hookup. Holler if you hear me.
And these two will be at the Southern Fried Gaming Expo this weekend. For anybody who will be there, go find them, say hi, get a sticker, have a picture taken, get an autograph. It'll be fun.
You don't want our autograph. It'll make anything that you have a sign less in value. So
I will sign anything and everything.
Oh.
Bring your own marker, though.
Exactly.
Every 5 minutes, I'm going to be like, Donnie, can you sign my arm? Can you sign?
All right, let's get the show started with our reviews, reactions, and requests. Mr. Knight Rider says, congrats on 6 months. Appreciate your time and effort to inform and entertain us. Cheers all. Mbop.
Mbop.
Yeah.
She's had enough of that.
New Dad Gaming says, never heard of the Polyam NFT console until this episode. Thank you for your service. We are just doing our job, sir. Bed Magnet the Tarnished said, don't know about teaching games in elementary school. That sounds like a bad idea, but having a college course on video game history, now that I'd happily take / teach. Well, we do have one of those, sort of, taught by our own Professor Ryebread.
Could you imagine your local community college or local university actually teaching a video game history class and you being like an adjunct teacher to come in and kind of drop some knowledge on them, that would be awesome.
Donnie, you just basically said what my life's dream is.
To be an adjunct on somebody else's gaming history course?
No, just to be a professor of gaming history at your local community college. Community college, yes. Which means I don't have to do research. I can dress the way I want to. That's the perfect
job. No, you should be required to wear a tweed jacket and have a pipe.
You know what? I could rock that look. I could definitely do that. I could pull it off. Talking a faux British accent the entire time.
Are you going to give us a demonstration?
Absolutely not.
Come on.
How are you going to lecture in front of a class if you won't even demonstrate for us?
Hello, students. Thank you for attending Professor Rybread's Gaming History 101.
That wasn't so bad, was it? I'll give you good reviews at the end of the semester.
I appreciate that. Go on, Blackboard.
And now, it's time for the...
Very important. Oh!
You seem to favor, like, these monstrous villain voices.
Holy shit, it was Mr. Shadow from Fifth Element there.
All right.
Money is of no importance. I want the stones.
I love that movie.
Yes, yes, me too. Every Monday on Twitter, we post our VIP, very important poll. If you'd like to participate, follow us on Twitter at GamersWeekPC. The Famicom turns 39 this Friday, and the question for this week was, in your opinion, what is the best NES/Famicom game of all time? Coming in at third place was Mega Man 2 at 10.4%. Following up in second place was TLOZ, and if you don't know, if you don't have the 411, that's The Legend of Zelda at 22.3%. And our winner, an overwhelming 56.5%, Super Mario Brothers 3. Now, 10.7% of you guys said others, so let's go ahead and take a look at those comments from the poll. At Sarge Smash 1 says, incredibly difficult choice. If I'm rolling RPGs, it's Dragon Warrior 4. If not, probably Kirby's Adventure. But there are other fantastic games like the other poll options. Bionic Commando, The Guardian Legend, Contra, Super C. There's a reason I still play the NES a ton. And he's got a damn good point.
And a damn good name. Sarge Smash. I love that.
Sarge Smash.
Exactly.
Spider2K1 says it's between... Is this why you made me read this?
It was your turn. It's just a wonderful coincidence.
It's between Bubble Bobble or Snake Rattle and Roll. My two favorites, even today, could sit down and play all day. That's your opinion, sir. CalmWin32 says, for me, it's a toss-up. I played SNES before NES, so I had to step back from 16-bit, and some of the usual choices didn't hit as hard for me. Those that did leave an impression on me were Final Fantasy, Castlevania 3, and later Final Fantasy 3 on an emulator.
That's the Japanese 3.
Oh, God.
I knew you were going to be like, whoa, I thought it was sick.
Well, it doesn't have another name in America, so.
That's right. That's right.
Izuna says, Ninja Gaiden, I think, was the very first video game with the idea of telling the story like it was a movie with still images. Some of them with a little effect here and there to give the feeling of movement. It was the grandma or grandpa of the FMVs and in-game cutscenes later. My fave. And Sky Blue Monty says, Hydlide. That's one you don't hear of that often.
Troll!
Yeah, there's a
troll in the dungeon. Thought you should know.
Troll! So definitely a large library of games. And to be named the best game on that specific console, I mean, it has to hold some weight. Blue, what was your favorite game from the NES/Famicom?
I decided to join the majority here and go with Super Mario Brothers 3 because not only is it a fantastic game that still holds up today just as well, but you remember all the hype surrounding the release of it back in the day, how big it was. We were starving to death for any sort of news about Super Mario Brothers 3. If you saw a magazine that had a little blurb in it, like in the grocery store, you had to run over and read it. Getting your parents to take you to see The Wizard because it was in that movie. So it was a big deal. And then when it actually launched, it did not disappoint because it kind of redefined what, at least for me, what I thought platform video games could do. Like, remember in the first level when you can go behind the scenery?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that was nuts. Where else had you ever done that? And you could fly. Mario could fly. That was crazy. And you get a little farther in game, and the sun is actually an enemy. I mean, it was all kinds of stuff that we'd never seen before. And at least for like little child me, really raised the bar as far as what I wanted to see out of video games in the future.
The sun is always an enemy to fair-skinned people. Remember that.
This is true. Set the stage for the rest of my life.
Ryan, what about you?
So it says, what is the best? So I'm going to agree with Blue that I think, objectively, Super Mario Bros. 3 is the best game. But for my answer, I'm going to provide a few of my favorite titles based off of kind of like genres. So if you're talking RPG, I got to agree with Sarge Smash. Dragon Warrior 4 is fantastic. If you're talking like run and gun games, it's somewhere between Contra and Mega Man. Mega Man 2 being kind of the bright spot of all the NES Mega Man games. But for me, like my favorite game overall is probably Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. That to me, it's just a great game. I'm not going to describe why I like that because it sounds like Donnie wants to.
No, I was grunting like that because I agree with you.
Gotcha, gotcha. The large size of the sprites was really appealing to me as a kid, and it really holds up nowadays because of things like the tight controls. The replayability, the fact that it has a time system in there as well, so you can kind of keep playing to see if you can get a better time. There's a bunch of secrets within the game itself to take down the fighters a lot easier. And there's something about being able to say, I can beat Mike Tyson that feels good. I'm not somebody who is really great at video games, but that's like one thing I can do, and I'm pretty proud of that. So
here's
my response.
What about you, Donnie? What's your favorite? Or what do you think is the best one?
Out of the stuff that was listed, definitely Super Mario Brothers 3. I mean, the other two are great games in their own right. But like you said, when Super Mario Brothers 3 came out, it was completely different than its predecessor, than Super Mario Brothers. You can now fly. I mean, that was, like you said, you got the frog suit, the Tanuki suit. You can go behind the scenes. You can just do so many more things. And it seemed like it was vastly different than Super Mario Brothers 2, which, yes, each character had their own unique abilities. And that was that was definitely interesting in its own time. So
yeah, but did you know it's not a Mario game?
Well, I do know that it's not a Mario game, but it's still.
You don't have to explain it. I just wanted to.
I'm gonna go out on a limb here and actually say that it is in fact a Mario game. It was made by Nintendo. Miyamoto was involved, and basically they wanted to make a Mario game for something else, and they were like, "Wait, why don't we just make this a Mario game?"
I just wanted to be that guy for a second. I didn't necessarily want to open a can of worms.
Actually,
yeah.
And that is my response typically to that guy.
To your point with Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, that is a game that I can pick up any day of the week and play and have fun with and challenge myself to get through the cadre of boxers to see if I can take down Mike Tyson. Or, you know, if I'm feeling frisky, I just put in the code and get straight to Mike Tyson and lay his ass down. Super Mario Brothers 3, again, challenging. That's a game that it's like an endurance trial where it's going to take a long time for you to sit there and complete it. So I'm more apt to play Mike Tyson's Punch Out because of how quickly I guess I can get through the game.
So faster is better?
In that sense, yes.
Dirty.
I did say it was dirty 30.
You did indeed.
All right, well, let's move on to our patron shoutouts.
Couldn't do what we do without the help of our gorgeous patrons. Here are the generous folks supporting Gamers Week on Patreon. Love Retro BTW, Steven San, Ramboski, Terry Kinnair, Ducks in Disguise, Jim and Colleen, Games of Coffee, Davey PGH, the Redox PDX family, including Shannon and Luke. Zach, huge thanks. Random Retro Dude, Princess Kitty Mew Mew, Rai Rai's secret best friend, Mega Retro Man, Gametroid, Emo S, Bill Tucker, Rye Bread's number one fan, Fruitcake's number one stan, The Wizard of Zardoz, Clayman 71, Great Saiyaman 81, BNT Zilla Guy, Geek With That, Crunchy Kong, Sheriff Snack, and Frank Grande. So if you like what you hear today, and we really hope that you do, please consider joining us on Patreon. Your support helps cover the cost of producing this show, as well as other cool stuff we'll be doing like prizes and giveaways. You'll also gain access to our patron-only bonus cast called Gamers Week Uncut, Patrons with Benefits. Visit patreon.com/gamersweek or follow the link in the show notes to learn more. And by the way, happy birthday to Games of Coffee. I know it's a little belated when this comes out, but happy birthday, bud.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Coffee. Happy birthday, Mega Retro Man.
Oh, yes. There we go.
Oh, hey, many patron birthdays.
And happy anniversary to Rye Bread's number one fan.
Oh.
10 years.
Happy congratulations. All right, let's move on to our headlines for the night. And our headline segment is, of course, proudly sponsored by the Retro Game Club podcast. It's a fantastic, family-friendly retro gaming podcast. In each episode, Rob and Hugh pick two games to play and discuss, as well as news, interviews, and other topics. Currently, they're playing through Temple of Doom and Raiders of the Lost Ark. Visit them at retrogameclub.net or follow the link in the show notes.
Is that Lost Art or Lost Ark?
Lost Ark. It's a typo.
Okay. Say the show notes, it says art, and all I'm thinking of is the story of how the Mona Lisa got stolen. I think they should turn that into a video game. Just saying.
It's a heist. Alrighty, from GameSpot, GameStop fires top executive. Layoffs include staff at Game Informer.
Informer.
Video game retailer GameStop, which is in the process of pivoting its business around crypto, has fired one of its top executives and laid off a number of staff, including members of Game Informer. In a filing with the U.S. government, GameStop said it terminated CFO Michael Recupero effective immediately. Recupero started as GameStop CFO just about a year ago in June 2021. The cuts appear to be mainly at GameStop's Grapevine, Texas office, though workers at the retailer's magazine Game Informer were also affected. This was just the latest round of staffing reduction at GameStop, as the company's corporate headquarters had layoffs at the end of May 2022, impacting more than 100 people in a variety of positions. These moves are happening as GameStop continues to lose lots of money. GameStop management said it is in the midst of transforming its business away from being known as a decaying traditional brick-and-mortar retailer into a technology-led organization. Looking to the future, GameStop said it plans to rebuild and strengthen its commerce business after years of underinvestment. What's more, the company is looking to crypto, NFTs, and Web 3.0 as vectors of growth. To that end, GameStop recently announced plans to launch the GameStop NFT marketplace later this year. This will allow users to store, send, receive, and use cryptocurrencies and NFTs across decentralized apps. Oh, GameStop, what are you doing?
Right.
Well, I mean, that's like the initial response, right? Is like, why on earth would you pivot away from what has been successful for you for decades into NFTs, into this fad that is currently in a downswing and you have no idea where it's going to go in the future? So it seems silly to base your whole business off of that. But on the other hand, as we've seen, GameStop's business is going the way of Blockbuster and Toys R Us, where there is no reason for it to exist, basically. Anything that they have, you can get online, probably cheaper and faster. So when you look at it from that perspective, how else should they save the company?
Well, and not to mention the trade-in value, whenever you go in and take your old games to them, they don't want to give you that much.
Right.
I understand it because it's a brick and mortar store and they have overhead to take care of. But if I can go and sell my stuff on eBay, Mercari, or Facebook Marketplace and still get a premium for it, I'm going to go there.
Right. And it takes a little extra effort. Or if I'm just going to get, you know, a couple bucks back for games that I'm selling, then I'm at least going to go to a local store and sell them there so that the money that's made stays more in the community. But if I were GameStop, I guess I don't know what else I would do.
I think the problem is that they gambled, though, and this, and I hate to say this, but I think this is probably that one of the last nails in the coffin as far as GameStop goes, because at the end of the day, if they're losing that amount of money they've invested in this NFT crypto market and that's tanking, you know, what do they got left?
Right.
I think we all grew up with places like GameStop and EB Games and Funko Land and Babbage's and all that stuff. But that's not what modern gamers or how they purchase their games. Then no matter what you're doing, you're probably not going to be able to recuperate that loss. And honestly, as far as a business model is concerned, sometimes it's better just to close up shop and
just to give up,
cut your losses, especially when you're talking about investors' money and all that good stuff. I don't know. Because them switching over to this send and receive cryptocurrencies and NFTs across decentralized apps, are they now just a crypto marketplace? Is it going to be GameStop, the crypto marketplace?
It seems like that, or they're just an exchange.
Right.
So what does that have to do with games anymore?
Right. That's the, kind of that. Is GameStop the crypto marketplace?
Well, unless they're talking about NFTs and crypto being used in specific games, like maybe let's just say one game has a specific currency that you can go ahead and trade in for a different currency on another app. So they'll have conversion rates, like you put a lot of time and money into this particular game, but you're kind of tired of it. But you as a gamer get something back from it. So you take your currency from them, exchange it through GameStop, switch it to another game, and now you have that money that you can spend on this particular app. I'm just spitballing here. I don't know if that's actually a thing, but it sounds like they're trying to be an exchange, and that's it.
If you're talking about creating cryptocurrencies and NFTs for a marketplace that's game-related, this would work probably 4 or 5 years down the line. Most people aren't sold on this idea of cryptocurrencies and NFTs in gaming, even though game companies are trying to push it. But they're also getting a lot of pushback from that. So most of these places, especially with the market tanking, have been like, let's rethink this process.
Right.
So could that change in the future? Absolutely. Could games be riddled with NFTs? Could in-game currency be based off of cryptocurrency? Absolutely. That is a certain possibility. And if game companies had their own way, that would be the case. But GameStop is trying to invest in the future, but they don't have enough time in order to get there. Yikes.
And you can't push without getting a little pushback.
Right.
I'm just picturing taking my game-based NFTs to GameStop and, hey, I want to trade these in. They're like, well, we can only give you 38 cents for these. You know, sorry, that's just the way it is.
But I paid $5 million for them.
It would be in their cryptocurrency, which I'm assuming is going to be called the decaying traditional brick and mortar coin.
That's kind of a mouthful.
DTBAM. Yeah. All right, from GameIndustry.biz, PAX organizer Reed Pop to run E3 2023. The Entertainment Software Association announced today that E3 2023 will be organized in partnership with Reed Pop. The latter is the company behind PAX, EGX, Star Wars Celebration, New York Comic Con, and other events, as well as the owner of several leading game media and brands, including GameIndustry.biz. Huh. This article might be pointless.
Conflict of interest.
Right. Together, the two organizations will host E3 2023 in its traditional home at the Los Angeles Convention Center during the second week of June. The event will encompass both digital showcases and in-person components that will also be open to consumers. We are thrilled to bring back E3 as an in-person event with Reed Pop, a global leader in producing pop culture events, said ESA President and CEO Stanley Pierre-Louis. The past 3 years have confirmed that E3 convenes our industry like no other event. Reed Pop brings world-class talent and a keen understanding of the video game industry, which will serve to enhance the E3 experience for years to come.
Can I say that we should make it a point to get to E3 2023? All right. Okay. That idea was shut down and shot down like a World War II fighter plane.
I'd be down. I was just waiting to hear Blue's response. And the silence. The silence was telling.
You guys are going to have to pick which con you want me to go to. Do you want me to go to Midwest Gaming Classic? Do you want me to go to E3? Do you want me to go to
PRG?
Yeah, PRG.
Why not?
You got to pick one.
All of them?
I don't think I can make it to all of them. I know I can make it to one of them. So you decide which is the most important.
No, I'm just saying this would be a pretty nice event for us to go to as a podcast because we get to see things firsthand, all of the indie stuff that's coming out, all of the AAA titles, and kind of report on them. And yeah, that's something we can still do if we watch the showcase at our homes. But to be able to experience this, talk to people, and actually hear from them, you know, get their own opinions, their word of mouth directly into your ear holes, you know, being able to ask the questions that you want to ask, I think this would be a grand opportunity.
It would be. And especially since it will be organized by ReadPop now, who, as it says, has done a ton of fan events. This could really be what E3 needs to kind of get itself back into being relevant again. This statement, the past 3 years have confirmed that E3 convenes our industry like no other event. Is that really what the past 3 years showed?
Yeah.
I must have been watching a different E3.
I think the past 3 years have showed us that we don't really need
E3. That we didn't miss E3 at all. That's what the past 3 years have shown. So
bring it back and do something different with it.
Yeah, if ReadPop can turn this into a party for video game fans, it might be able to save itself.
Yeah, I think this is just what the doctor ordered for E3. Let's be honest. Because prior to this acquisition,
partnership.
Partnership, that's the word. We didn't really know if E3 was ever going to be a thing again. There was whispers of it, potentially. But yeah, this is kind of a breath of fresh air as well, I would imagine, for E3. And maybe this is an opportunity now for E3 to become what it was for us back in the day for the next generation. So, right. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. Maybe you'll see us at E3.
Notice that little giggle behind.
We just need somebody to provide us with airfare, a per diem, hotel stay. Yeah. Then we're there. So
we'll be that big by that time. We've got a year to start getting 10,000 downloads a week. It's fine.
No problem. We can do that, right?
It's fine. That's fine. Everything's fine.
All right, next up from Ars Technica, Bayonetta 3 on Switch will include an optional put on more clothes mode. Most fans of the Bayonetta franchise will no doubt be happy to hear that the upcoming Bayonetta 3, which is now planned for an October 28 release exclusively on the Switch, will feature a title character that's sexier than ever, according to the developer Platinum Games. But for players who have young children in the house and still want to play right in the living room without having to worry about what's on screen, Platinum says it will include a mode that covers up some of the partial nudity the series is known for. In a tweeted video, Platinum shows how Naive Angel Mode will add additional cover. Naive Angel Mode.
Right?
Will add additional covering to Bayonetta and other characters that might be showing a little too much skin for sensitive players. While this new family-friendly mode will tone down the nudity, it's unclear if it will also limit the over-the-top violent torture attacks that will be making a return in the upcoming sequel. Family-friendly filters like this aren't completely unheard of in video games. Gore filters that censor the most violent scenes are available in games like Sunset Overdrive and Gears of War, to name just a few. And don't forget the Mortal Kombat Blood Code that served a similar purpose for some 90s console gamers. Nintendo, for its part, has reportedly been trying to encourage more M-rated games on its platform since 2017.
That statement blows my freaking mind.
It's almost right up there with seeing Sonic games on a Nintendo console. It's as mind-blowing.
Things that'll never happen on a Nintendo console.
Right, I was thinking Howard Lincoln is sitting in his house just gritting his teeth. Fur.
Like Joe Pesci from Home Alone. Ratcha, fratcha.
This is a big deal for Bayonetta fans. Bayonetta 3 was announced back in 2017, so it's been a hot minute.
Oh, yeah.
So the internet was basically exploding today with news of this. But what do you guys think of this naive angel mode?
I don't hate it. I mean, I've never played a Bayonetta game. I understand that it's the over the top, busty, sexy females doing moves and stuff. And I guess these torture attacks. So are we talking like, is this a BDSM game for the most part?
No, it's what you do to the enemies. You like throw them into spiked wheels, or I think they get their heads chopped off. Or
Okay. So that's kind of like the Punisher for the PS2. It was over the top graphic like that. I don't hate the fact that they're trying to cover this up so children can't see it. If that's what you want to do, if you have that option, great. Go ahead and turn that on. If not, if you don't care what your children see, by all means, don't turn on this option. Yeah, it doesn't affect me either way.
Yeah, fair.
I think that's the biggest point of this, is that it does not affect you either way. Where, if you looked at the blood code, you would have to go in and fix it in order to get the level of violence that you wanted.
Oh, I was furious back then.
So much.
To 90s kids, that was a big deal.
It was. But the point being is, because it does not affect you, who cares? It's a choice, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of similar to if they add an easy mode option and you don't want to play easy mode, then don't freaking play easy mode. Who cares?
Right. And they've done this a couple times. Like Cyberpunk has an option where you don't see all the nudity. Since in Cyberpunk, you can, you know, customize your character's junk and all that kind of stuff. You can do an option that just doesn't show that. But it's kind of funny that the idea that they would remove the nudity and still leave the violence.
Yeah, right.
Right. I mean, because those kind of go hand in hand. It like, oh, you don't want your kids to see nudity. I completely understand that. But you're willing to let them sit there and watch somebody's head get twisted apart and their eyeballs just shoot out like rockets. Like, that's okay?
I mean, I guess some houses are like that, but maybe also there's just some games you shouldn't play in front of your kids.
Absolutely. From Nintendo Life, voice of Zelda in CDI games would love to return to the role. It's been 84 years. The Legend of Zelda CDI games might not have had much going for them, but one thing that was arguably impressive was the voice acting. Bonnie Jean Wilbur was the original Princess Zelda in the series, providing the voice for the character in the 1993 Philips CDI releases Link, The Faces of Evil, and Zelda, The Wand of Gamelon. In a recent interview with the website Game Reviews, the voice actor mentioned how she would be all for reprising her roles as Princess Zelda. Recently, she's also agreed to return to the role, to work on a homage to the original CDI series, not affiliated with Nintendo. "I would return to voice Zelda if asked. I love doing theater, but voice acting is more lucrative. We were contacted by someone who is doing an homage to the CDI series, and he asked us if we wanted to reprise our roles. It's not affiliated with Nintendo. We agreed to it, so that should be interesting." Nowadays, Zelda is voiced by Patricia Somerset, who most recently reprised her role as the princess in Hyrule Warriors: Age of Calamity.
So what I think should happen is that we should set up a cage match between Bonnie and Patricia, and the one who comes out of the cage match first is now officially Princess Zelda. Just going to throw that out there.
Well, that's what I was going to ask is, I mean, this thing says one thing that was arguably impressive was the voice acting. I've never played them. Can anybody verify if that's true?
Yeah, it's, I would say she's probably the most normal sounding voice in that entire game.
So if the voice acting is not impressive, what would you call it?
Workable is what I would call it.
Okay.
The other voices are weird, creepy, or awful, or corny, like Link is. He's like, "Oh man, I can't wait to bomb some Dodongos." And the other ones are just somebody pretending to be like an old person or a scary person. You could tell it's like somebody forcing it. So,
okay.
But like I said, she's the normal one. Like, her voice sounds fine. Is it like, oh my God, this is the voice I hear when I think of Zelda? Absolutely not.
Right.
But, I hope someday to be known as the normal one for my work.
Out of the three of us, you might be.
I mean, because you actually, there was another actress who did voiceover work for the Legend of Zelda cartoon series, Cynthia Preston. Yep, she voiced Princess Zelda. So you get Cynthia Preston, Patricia Somerset, and Bonnie Jean Wilbur in a cage match, and you have them to the death, and the winner gets to be the voice of Zelda going forward.
I love that. You know what? Rather than a cage match, let's do a cage match with a letter match as well. And on top is the Princess Zelda crown. And that's what they got to get off of that little rope that hangs down. So they got the ladder, they got the cage, you know, barbed wire, whatever it is.
No rules.
Exactly. No rules, just right.
And tickle fights and all that stuff.
The one thing about this, though, if you think about it, there are going to be so many people out there that go, huh?
Right. I've never even heard of a CDI.
Right. Right. Like, we know it because we're nerds, but we're not your average person.
Right.
It's like, man, I really love the voice acting on that one game on the Apple Pippin. You know?
It's like, oh, the dude that played the Scat Commander in Night Trap, he should have gotten a freaking Emmy, man.
Yes, yes.
That stash was legendary.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Okay, podcast idea. Interviewing voice actors from obscure roles from obscure games.
Yes. Ooh. Sold.
Free idea, someone. You're welcome. Unless you want it, Donnie. I'm not editing another podcast.
No, I thought we could do that. We could have guests on our podcast for that.
I guess we could.
I don't see why not.
Well, the fact that I've been poking fun at Bonnie, she's probably not going to want to come on this.
You never know.
But I mean, let's be serious, though. She did the voice for the Zelda for the CDI games. That's just going to happen. It comes with the territory.
Right.
And you said she was the normal one, so that was nice.
I was being complimentary in that sense, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But she probably is friends with all the other people. Look what this jerk said on the Gamers Week podcast about us.
All right, let's move on to our top three new releases of the week.
Starting off is Time on Frog Island. The platform is PlayStation 5, Xbox Series X and S, PlayStation 4, Xbox One, Switch, and PC. Cast away on an island paradise complete with a cast of friendly frogs. Enjoy sandbox island life and explore at your own pace, solving sticky situations for your new friends and trading away to fixing your ship. I'm sorry I read it like that, but it just seemed like it was written in that way. Loopmancer. Platform is PC. Loopmancer is a 3D platformer roguelite action game with realistic graphics that takes place in a cyberpunk universe. Players play as a detective who comes back to life after unexpected death and battle in this lifelike and futuristic city of the East. And finally, Escape Academy. Platform is PlayStation 5, Xbox Series X and S, PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and PC. Welcome to Escape Academy. Train to become the ultimate escapist. Solve puzzles, hack servers, meet the faculty, brew the perfect cup of tea, escape rooms in single player or co-op mode with a friend, local or online. And I just want to say, if you have to include brew the perfect cup of tea in your game description, what a snooze fest. So taking a look at these three, blue, which is tickling your fancy.
What an interesting choice of words.
Thank you. Thank you.
I think I'm going to go with the Snooze Fest. I'm going to go with Escape Academy.
I like it.
The Time on Frog Island, it kind of sounds like it's Animal Crossing-ish. Loopmancer, I have a lot of roguelites already sitting in my backlog. But Escape Academy, solve puzzles, hack servers. It seems like Harry Potter, but with puzzles instead. So maybe if you just walk around the game solving puzzles the whole time, that could be fun. At least an escape room video game is not something that I've heard of before, so I'd be willing to give it a look.
Excellent. Donnie, what about you?
I'm kind of in the similar boat. Time on Frog Island does not look appealing to me. It looks very Animal Crossing-ish, Farmville type stuff. No way. Loopmancer looks like my choice for the week. You had me at Cyberpunk, so I really love that type of theme. From what I'm seeing from Loopmancer as far as the visual aesthetics, it looks right up my alley. Escape Academy didn't really do a good job in the description, but if you're solving puzzles, you're hacking servers, I do like those types of games. And seeing the screenshots, like one of them is a room where you've got, I guess, some books on a shelf and you have to do those in the correct order to open up something. I like that. This is nothing new to me. Games I've like Seventh Guest and 11th Hour have those elements. I really like those because it challenges me. So my two picks would be Loopmancer and Escape Academy. Ryan, what's your pick for this week?
Gonna go with Loopmancer. Time on Frog Island sounds nowhere near my alley. Escape Academy, I do like occasional puzzle games. I do like escape rooms. I don't know. This just sounds, like you said, like Harry Potter-ish. And that to me is corny. I'm sorry.
I didn't say it wasn't corny.
Fair enough. Where Loopmancer sounds more, I don't know, the kind of game that I could at least get into. I love the idea that you're a detective that comes back to life after unexpected death. That's kind of cool. Anything that cyberpunk related is always something I'm into. So I think that'll probably be the best bet out of the three. But honestly, I will probably not pick up any of these games at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's a kind of a rough week.
For sure.
Right. If it was a free trial, maybe I'd give it a look. But spending money on these games? Nah.
All right, let's move on to our main topic for the night. From USA Today, worst video games of all time, according to Metacritic. What does it truly mean to be called one of the worst video games of all time? While such a list could easily be filled with Steam asset flips that use your hardware to mine cryptocurrency, the gaming world has collectively decided that those games aren't worth discussing. You could even argue they're not really games. A much better metric for finding the worst games ever is Metacritic, which collects review scores from across the internet and takes an average out of 100. The lowest rated games on the site are games prominent enough that big reviewers saw potential in them, only for that hope to be dashed with some truly diabolical games. We've gone to the very bottom of Metacritic's rankings to tell you what the worst video games of all time are and what reviewers said about them.
Coming in at number 7, Deal or No Deal, released July 23, 2007 for the Nintendo DS. It had a Metacritic score of 20. Although Deal or No Deal is a huge hit of a game show, it's never worked as a video game. Without the stakes of real money being on the line, the gameplay is robbed of any tension because it's all just meaningless numbers, like our bank accounts. Regardless, the Wii version of Deal or No Deal did fine for itself because it wasn't as utterly broken as the DS version. It completely removed the random chance for the game by always putting the money in the same cases when you reboot your system, which defeats the entire point of Deal or No Deal.
I'm going to argue something here real quick. It said it never worked as a video game because money wasn't at stake. If you've ever been to a Dave and Buster's, there's a Deal or No Deal for tickets. And that's real money. So I can trade it in for a koosh or a pencil.
Ooh, a pencil.
Right. That is real currency on the line. So
yeah, I think I get what they say. You know, you've got games like on the NES, like Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy and stuff like that. It really doesn't mean anything. Yeah. To their point, it's all meaningless.
This is the creme de la creme of shovelware, basically.
Pretty much. Yeah. All right. Next up, number 6, Alone in the Dark Illumination, released July 11, 2015. Platform was PC. Metacritic score of 19. It's heartbreaking to see a beloved horror series like Alone in the Dark go down the drain, but it's hard to argue given what a disaster this game turned out to be. The game made the baffling decision to allow up to 4-player co-op and focus gameplay on staying in the light to stay safe, making it a game where you're neither alone nor in the dark. If that wasn't enough to sink in, releasing in a half-broke state certainly was.
It sounds like a Seinfeld thing. What's the deal with Alone in the Dark Illumination? You're neither alone nor in the dark.
Boom, 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 boom.
All All right, number five is Spogs Racing, released July 7, 2008 on the Wii with a Metascore of 18. To answer the question I'm sure you've just asked, a Spog is a sports player object gyro. And if that makes sense to you, then you must be one of the game's developers. It was a standard Mario Kart ripoff that wasn't uncommon in the 2000s, but this one managed to be especially bad with ugly graphics and some of the worst racing AI out there, and not to mention a name that makes you go, what?
Now, is it pronounced gyro or yiro?
I was just going to say.
Because I'm envisioning a sandwich, a Greek sandwich.
On wheels, that's the vehicle?
Yes, as the vehicle, right?
Nice, nice.
Shoots out, like, you know, pieces of lamb.
Tzatziki?
Yeah. Tzatziki, yes.
Tzatziki cloud, right?
Yeah.
It's squirt.
Please, somebody make this game.
That's got to be somewhere on Steam already, like a sandwich kart racer.
Okay, let me collect myself for a second. Right?
Donnie really likes the idea of sandwich kart racers.
I do. You got your different sandwiches. You got your Reuben. You got your Nero. You got your hoagie.
Each one has different stats. What's the fastest sandwich?
Coming in at number four.
So, do you want me to read this one?
I got it.
Okay.
Coming in at number four, Double Dragon 2, Wander of the Dragons. Release date, April 5th, 2013. Platform, Xbox 360. Metascore of 17. Once again, dragging a classic franchise into the mud. Double Dragon 2, Wander of the Dragons is perhaps the worst beat-em-up brawler ever made. Not only are the graphics awful by 2013 standards, but it struggled to run at anything close to an acceptable frame rate. Combat was extremely dull at the best of times and impossible at the worst of times, with enemies able to gang up on you continuously.
And I love the phrasing here, because it made me think it's the tale of two dragons. The combat was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
And maybe in the game is just all about the dragon is wandering around. Wander of the Dragons. What a weird name.
Right.
And at first I was like, Double Dragon 2? Oh, I see. It's on the Xbox 360. We're not talking about the NES. Yeah. Like, I was like, I thought that was pretty good. Next up, number three, Leisure Suit Larry, box office bust. Foreshadowing.
Right.
Release date, May 5th, 2009. Platform, PlayStation 3, Metascore 17. This game would have sat comfortably in the mix with any of the awful movie tie-in action platformers this generation was famous for. Like most of those games, this was just a dull experience from start to finish. The more nuanced sexual humor of the original games was out the window in favor of trashy jokes that were often sexist and unfunny. It was most definitely a sign that this sort of game was no longer wanted.
Poor Leisure Suit.
Yep.
Poor Larry.
Larry's got to learn to read the room, man.
I think there's probably still a place in this world for Larry, but just better than this.
Right.
All right, coming in at number two, Ride to Hell Retribution, released June 24, 2013 on the PC with a Metascore of 16. Ride to Hell Retribution is one of the more infamous terrible games, but it isn't quite the worst ever on Metacritic. It's deserving of the runner-up spot, though, with laughable biking gameplay and boring on-foot combat, plus a story that doesn't make any sense, and multiple fully clothed sex scenes that'll leave you rolling your eyes for days.
What?
And this is what we're talking about with Bayonetta 3, because it wasn't an option, right?
God. Coming in at number one, Family Party, 30 Great Games Obstacle Arcade. Release date, December 4th, 2012. Platform, Wii U, Metascore 11. The Wii was full of compilation party games, some of which were the best Wii games, but none of them managed to be quite as bad as this offering on the Wii U. Not only did it have backwards and terrible controls, but it required you to own two Wiimotes and two nunchucks for the privilege. Visually, it could be put to shame by a PS2 game, and it doesn't even work half the time.
Ouch.
Holy crap.
Burn.
Yeah, that's F's in the chat for this one.
One thing about looking through this entire list, did anyone notice that all the games range from 2007 to 2015?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's 8 years of shit.
It's like the golden age of shovelware. It's where the consoles were advanced enough that devs should have known better. And yet, here we are with these games.
You have a great point. They should have known better, but they didn't. Maybe this was the time where they felt like they could push the boundary a little bit and just like put out whatever they want because, oh, it's a game. People will buy it.
The same thing happened in 1982.
That's true. That is very true. And look what happened.
We're lucky that it didn't create the video game crash of 2013.
So have you guys played any of these games?
Not a single one.
Nope. There are some I've never even heard of, like Spog's Racing.
Well, yeah. Sounds like there's a reason for that. So what games would you put on this list?
Ooh. So this one's a personal opinion one, but the game that I have, and this is going to be a pun kind of intended, dreaded the most is Judge Dredd on the Super Nintendo. Have you guys ever played that game?
No.
Yes, I have.
That's outside of our time range.
Oh, that's true. Right. I'm sorry. I apologize for not being in the shovelware time frame. But it's a confusing gameplay. It's not very fun. The whole idea is that you're going around sentencing bad guys and that kind of stuff. But I remember not being able to get past the first level or two and just being so mad at my mom that she bought me a Judge Dredd game. So for one, I didn't know what the game was because I wasn't old enough to see Judge Dredd when that came out. That's an R-rated right. movie. So for one, I wasn't nostalgic for the content. Two, you turn it on, it's just so confusing and bland. I wasn't aware of the comics. In fact, I wasn't aware of the comics until probably 10 years ago. So that was a thing. And it's poor gameplay. It's badly designed and it's boring. And I've always just had like this part of me that just hates ever loving, you know what, out of Judge Dredd. You know, there's going to be somebody who's going to tell me that, oh, I've been playing it wrong. And if you just do this, it's the most amazing game ever. It's number two.
Yeah, you just got to get good.
Right.
E.T. There you go.
But to me, that game was just awful. I couldn't stand it.
I know you're going to ask me, and I don't have that answer right now. You've got a trove of games to go through that to find a horrible one. I can't give you an answer.
All right. You take your time. I will posit for the list a game called Knock Knock, which I played on the Nintendo Switch several years ago. I think it was released in 2018. So again, no, sorry, it was released in 2013 on Steam. So it's a weird indie game that was crowdfunded on the idea that somebody found this kind of copy pasta file online that had scraps of text and weird audio recordings, and this stuff was all real disturbing. And so, you know, legend goes that the devs found this footage and then decided to make a game out of it. And the game that they made is about a lodge keeper in a lodge all by himself, slowly going crazy. And basically, there are two styles of levels. You either hide from ghosts who are coming into kill you, I guess. I don't know.
Or tickle you, whatever.
Whatever. Basically, what they do is they kind of run up and touch you, and then you have to start the level over. So I'm not really sure what happens. You're just stuck in a time loop, maybe. And then the other ones are seeking levels where there's a ticking clock somewhere and you have to find it. So I'm playing this game and I'm going through the level, and these two styles of levels alternate, but I can't, it's hard to tell if I'm making progress or not because the game never changes. Like, you know, if you're in a horror game, the scares are going to start out one way, and then throughout the game, they're going to change and progress so that the game stays scary, right?
Right.
That was what a good horror game will do. This game does nothing. It's exactly the same from start to finish. And then the whole time, it gives you no feedback on if you're playing correctly or not. Like, there's a lot of importance seems to be put on exploring the lodge, fixing light bulbs so the ghost can't come get you. And then there's these weird cryptic messages. Like sometimes you'll go to do something and a voice will say, don't do that. Like, okay, I won't do it.
Sorry, Dad.
Right. If you don't do it, nothing happens. If you do it, nothing happens. So it's like, and then by the end, I got soft locked. I couldn't finish the final level because I guess I hadn't played it right the whole time, but I don't know what I did wrong. So it was just so poorly done and so such a weird experience. I really, really hated that game.
And what was the name of it again?
Knock Knock. You can get it for $6.99 as a direct download on the eShop, and not recommended.
Way too much.
I wouldn't even get it if it was free, unless you're just morbidly curious about how bad it is.
I really don't have anything to offer just yet, other than, you know, the basic, you know, like Superman 64 or E.T. And yet, I know there are people who can sit there and defend E.T. the Extraterrestrial and be like, well, if you just read the manual, it's a great game.
I've said that. Yeah. Thank you for that voice. Because that's exactly what I sound like.
Exactly. And that's fine. That's your opinion. That's completely fine. I remember not.
Thank you for validating my opinion.
Your opinion matters.
Sorry, I won't interrupt anymore.
No, I like it. I like it. I remember playing E.T. as a kid, and yeah, I didn't like. I was like, I don't need to read the manual. Or I did read the manual. I just didn't click, and I was like, oh, this game's a piece of shit. Even like at 4 or 5 years old, I was like,
I imagine a little 4 or 5 year old Donnie saying,
"It's a piece of shit, man." Chucked it, never touched it again. In fact, I don't think I've ever touched that game or played it since then. If I can think of something else before the show ends, I'll touch on that. But right now, you got so many games up there that are swimming through there. I can't pick one out of the ether.
Okay, I'm going to ask you, why do you hate Bubble Bobble so much?
Is this where we sing the song?
It's just not my type of game. Truth be told, I don't hate it as much as I've been putting on. It's a front, it's a facade, whatever. It's just, I don't know, it's never been my type of game.
You've been faking it?
The entire relationship, I've been faking it.
I get that. I do that with the N64, so I get it. I totally get it.
So the N64 is not as bad as you make it out to be?
Yeah, but just don't tell anybody I said that.
Okay. I will. Zip. Lips are sealed.
Yep. Nobody will ever find out. All right. Before we move on, let's take a quick break to talk about our sponsor. Gaming History 101 is proudly sponsored by the Elitist Podcast. It's a show where three friends and occasional guests play games about video games, including trivia, game show games, and more. Here is this week's trivia question. Donna Bailey heard a song by the Pretenders that shared the name of an arcade game. After being introduced to the game, she became interested in video game programming and would go on to co-design Centipede. What was the song she heard / game she played? Tune into the Elitist Podcast this Wednesday to hear the answer. You can find the Elitist on your favorite podcast platform, and we'll also have their links in the show notes.
Outside of what the answer is, I like that this story of Donna Bailey, that's kind of cool that she heard a song and it, you know, was shared a name with an arcade game, and that was her muse to start programming and then created one of the best games of all time, Centipede.
Yeah,
so that's pretty interesting. It's pretty cool.
I do know the answer to this one.
Do you really?
Yes, I do.
And is it because you know the Pretender song?
No, it is not.
Okay.
There's definitely a game called Tattooed Love Boys. I played it. It's very
unique.
Thank you for coming, students. Please take your seats. Welcome back to Professor Rybrand's Gaming History 101. And in today's lesson, we're going to talk about a company and a game that helped cement Microsoft's Xbox console as being one of the big players in the marketplace. Of course, talking about Bungie and their mega smash hit Halo Combat Evolved. So before I jump into this, I've always been a huge fan of Halo. And in fact, it's the reason that I purchased an Xbox. But I was curious, have you guys had experience with Halo? Did you like it? Did you not like it?
Oh, yeah. Halo was huge back in the day. Though I more watched people play it than played it myself because I'm not really into shooters, it was still really fun to sit around and to watch, to listen to the music was amazing. And so I really enjoyed like the Halo culture, I guess, so to speak, even though I wasn't really a player.
Nice. Donnie, what about you?
Was not into Halo initially. I did play the subsequent releases, albeit briefly. But if I had to choose between Call of Duty, Modern Warfare, or Call of Duty, whatever, versus Halo, I was more towards the realistic World War II shooters.
My how times change.
I know. At the time, because that's all we had. I played Allied Assault Medal of Honor for years online. Yeah. And when Halo came out, I'm not that big into space sci-fi. So it just didn't tickle my fancy, if you will.
Gotcha. I was huge into it. I had friends that played it. I had friends that went to tournaments and play it. Me and my brother pitched in together to buy the green Halo Xbox. Like, it was a big deal. We really, really enjoyed this one. And I've played subsequent Halo games. And for a while, like, I was there for the midnight release of Halo 2. I played that religiously for a while. I played Halo 3 and 4. So I've always kind of been a fan of Halo. Not in the same sense of most people. I think most people play just the standard online multiplayer 4v4 kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Where I like to play a specific version of it known as SWAT, which is one shot head shots or one. Yeah, it would kill you. If you get shot in the head, you get killed. And then it's like a three shots to the body to get killed. So it's very fast, very difficult. So you got to be kind of on top of your game. And I've always loved that.
And I like that version as opposed to the Halo that just came out, where you had to dump like a full clip and a half in order to kill somebody. And that immediately turned me off.
Right. So maybe I just like Call of Duty, but in Halo. So, you know, why don't we at least start at the beginning when it comes to the company Bungie? So if you look at Halo, of course, it's one of the most popular game franchises in gaming. It helped drive the first-person shooter genre really into the zeitgeist that spawned many sequels, spinoffs. It even has its own show on Paramount Plus. I know Blue hasn't seen. I don't know if Donnie's not seen it, but I recommend it. So there you go.
I have not.
But there you go. But its beginnings were kind of rather humble and ended up being much more than it ever actually intended to be. So really, we kind of want to roll back time here and take a look at the beginning of Bungie. Now, Bungie, of course, created the game Halo, but it began in 1991 producing games for Max by Alex Seropian. I am definitely botching that one, so we're just going to call him Alex from here on out. And Jason Jones, and they programmed for the Mac rather than for Windows because there was a gap essentially in kind of gaming space within Macs, Apple Macs, versus the oversaturated market that was Windows PCs at the time. So interestingly enough, they saw some kind of mild success in the early years of their company when they released a game called Minotaur Labyrinth of Crete, which was a maze-based RPG top-down perspective game that allowed for online multiplayer, which was kind of cool. Interestingly enough, though, at the time, these were basically just two guys programming outside of their house, and they were running so lean at the time that they were boxing all the games themselves and then shipping them out to people. So they were boxing them, they were putting the stuff in there, they were closing it up, they were sealing the games all by themselves.
Damn.
But with the success of Minotaur, Bungie was able to produce a lot more games. And even at the time, I think they said that Alex and Jason were both kind of living off of spouse's income versus their own. So this was an opportunity to say, hey, we made enough off of this game that we can continue programming. So throughout the next few years, Bungie had made a handful of more games, the most popular of those being an online strategy game called Myth, The Fallen Lords, and a series of first-person shooter games called Marathon. Now, Myth was so popular, in fact, it helped catapult Bungie from a small developer into a much larger studio because it had this gorgeous online community with, you know, very active players that were really big into the game, word of mouth. They really essentially created this space for gamers who were interested in this style of gameplay. Now, Marathon, on the other hand, was a huge jump forward, essentially, in the first-person shooter genre. It was set in a futuristic landscape. It introduced two things to the FPS genre that you can find today. So one of them being rocket jumping, which is more towards Halo type games than it is Call of Duty. But it also included the ability to look up, down, side to side with the movement of your mouse rather than it just being a straightforward perspective. So they were able to kind of change the game when it came to aiming and things like that. So Marathon was so successful after the launch that many people regard it as an equivalent to Doom or System Shock, but for the Mac. Now, Bungie soon followed up the success of Marathon with a sequel called Marathon 2 that included the co-op mode. That gameplay element has really been a staple for many Bungie games moving forward. Now, Bungie saw even more success with this sequel, but decided to announce that their intention to release the game on Windows to only receive a massive amount of fan letters from avid Mac users describing their feelings of betrayal.
It's a little dramatic.
Yeah, we'll find out a little bit later who buys Bungie. The ultimate betrayal, right? But Bungie did not allow that to dissuade them and eventually released a version on Windows. Now, prior to the late 90s, though, they had thrown around the idea of creating another Marathon game. But at the time, they were thinking, okay, we'll make this tank-based combat, more or less. The unfortunate part is that they weren't really able to get the physics right for the game. So they ended up shelving that to focus more on Myth and its sequels. But eventually, a group of three Bungie staffers began to develop a real-time strategy game with a focus on science fiction, realistic physics simulations, and three-dimensional terrain. Early versions of the game actually used the engine from Myth and not Marathon, oddly enough, and experimenting with the ways of controlling units, Bungie actually added a mode that attached a camera to the individual units. So imagine playing StarCraft, but you can kind of see what's happening from the viewpoint of your Marine, which I think is awesome. I would love them to have a version of that. That would have been really cool. But the vantage point continually moved closer to the units as the developers realized it was more fun for players to drive the vehicles themselves rather than have the computer do it. And controlling the vehicle, according to Alex, said, just the double tactile nature of a load a dude in, get a dude out, hands on the steering wheel, it was like, this shouldn't be an RTS game.
Direct quote.
Right. It is a direct quote. By mid 1998, the game actually ended up becoming a third person shooter. So we're starting to see this game is changing over time. Now, as the game progressed into the development stage, Bungie, through personal connections, we'll say, was able to get an audience with Steve Jobs of Apple, who was super impressed by the game. And the working title of the game was Blam. Prior to that, it was Monkey Nuts.
Yeah, this game called Monkey Nuts, man.
But the lead programmer changed it after his mom asked what the name of the game was. Couldn't tell his mom it was Monkey Nuts. But other possible names were kicked around that included the Santa Machine, Soleopsis, the Crystal Palace, Hard Vacuum, Star Maker, and Star Shield.
That would be a really niche t-shirt.
Right.
You just had a list of all those names and people were like, what the heck is your t-shirt about? Like, yeah, I guess you're not cool.
Right. I knew Bungie before you did.
Yep.
So Bungie hired actually a branding firm that came up with the name Covenant, but Bungie artist
Paul Russell ended up suggesting some alternative names, which included Halo. Some people didn't really like that game, kind of likening it to something either religious or a woman's shampoo, apparently, as well.
What?
Yeah, I didn't. That was a weird one that I wasn't familiar with, but apparently Halo is a brand of shampoo for women.
If you'd sort of like someone to whistle at you, let Halo shampoo help you out. Because Halo leaves your hair soft and fragrant, shining with colorful highlights. Glorify your hair with Halo. America's favorite shampoo.
On July 21st, 1999, during the Macworld conference and expo, Steve Jobs actually announced that Halo would be released for Mac OS and Windows simultaneously. So he's kind of the one who named the game more or less officially and told everybody it's coming out on a Mac OS and Windows. Oops. So, interestingly, at this time, Bungie was struggling with their finances. And a lot of it had to do with a bug for their Myth 2 game that ended up wiping out your entire inventory. And you couldn't get it back. Yeah. Think about just getting through a game and having a glitch wipe out your entire inventory. Yeah. Those are the stuff that nightmares are made of. Now, they actually had to spend $800,000 recalling 200,000 copies of the game.
Jeez.
Yep. So, to help finance their projects moving forward, they sold shares of Bungie and publishing rights to Take-Two Interactive. But the investment wasn't enough really to cover their losses, so they ended up reaching out to Microsoft about a possible acquisition. And the deal went down like this, where Take-Two kept Myth and a game called Oni in exchange for Microsoft owning Bungie and Halo.
Which one got the better deal?
Right. Poor Take-Two. So once the deal was finalized, Bungie was now under the gun, pun intended, to take a loose assortment of games, play elements, and turn them into a fully functional game and launch title for a brand new system. Talk about pressure. So Jason Jones had the foresight to switch the game from a third-person shooter to a first-person shooter, but therein lied some of the challenges. Console FPS games were rare and struggled with aiming because you were using a controller versus a mouse and keyboard, and the processing speeds as well weren't really up to snuff. So what they did is they created aim assist feature, so that the movements would be closer to what the player wanted them to be rather than what the actual inputs were making in the game, which made it more entertaining for players. So if you ever wondered why I'm really good at Halo Online, but I can't play Call of Duty with a mouse and keyboard, that's your answer. So eventually Halo released in November of 2001 to kind of a mediocre reception at first, but eventually started to kind of gain traction and turned into one of the main reasons that people ended up purchasing an Xbox, myself included on that. Ended up selling by 2006, 4.2 million copies and received several Game of the Year awards. In fact, more than 40 awards for Halo. So kind of wrap things up, Bungie within 10 years went from two guys programming games and boxing them at their house to a studio that helped launch Microsoft into the console market. I think that's pretty amazing stuff. So thank you for attending today's lesson. Just a reminder, if you have any ideas for a story that you'd like to hear, send us a message at gamersweekpodcast@gmail.com and we might feature your suggestion.
All right, let's go ahead and wrap up the show. And thank you for listening to episode 30 of Gamers Week Podcast. And a big thank you to the Retro Game Club Podcast, The Leadist Podcast, and Love Retro BTW for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget to check out their links in the show notes. If you want to connect with Gamers Week, follow us on Twitter at Gamers Week PC, email us at gamersweekpodcast@gmail.com, visit our merch store at gamers-week-podcast.creator-spring.com, or if you want to do it the easy way, follow the link in the show notes. Join us on Patreon at patreon.com/gamersweek. And finally, since you made it all the way to the end of this episode, please leave us a rating and a review to let us know how we did. We really do value your feedback. And while you're there, consider subscribing on iTunes, Spotify, or your podcast platform of choice. That's it for us tonight. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you next week. And don't forget to find Ryan and Donnie at Southern Fried Gaming Expo if you're going to be there.
Come find us.
Say hello. We'll slap a sticker on your forehead.
Right. That'll bring them all in.
Any of the make your own video games from the Sega CD, like Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch, INXS, and Crisscross, those games are horrible.
Ah, there it is.
He really went with the Marky Mark game.
Up until this moment, I didn't even know there was a Marky Mark game.
Oh my God, it's funny too. It's super funny.
Can you feel it, baby? I can too.
Yeah, that's one of those. It's so bad, it's funny. It's like The Room, you know?
Right. Well, hi, Mark.
Which is funny. Oh, there you go. Hi, Mark.
Oh, hi, Marky Mark.
Good night, everybody.
Yeah,
good night.
Halo.
Welcome to Gamers Week Uncut.
Welcome to Gamers Week Uncut.
Welcome to Gamers Week Uncut, patrons with benefits. This is the unscripted, patron-only bonus cast with less editing and more dirty jokes. We don't know where the conversation will go, but we're sure it will be weird.
This fish just went right on my nipple, and I'm just like...
I Google Street Fighter 6. The first search result that comes up is people think they can see Ryu's dick in the Street Fighter 6 reveal.
Listen up here, kids. You're not going to want to get one of those VDSTDs things, right? Make your dick fall off. When you go, grab a pro. You'll be doing it for America.
That was perfect.
If you want to hear weekly episodes of our patron-only bonus cast, join us at patreon.com/gamersweek.